Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman. Glucksman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, we hope that you had a lovely Thanksgiving holiday and that you're gearing up for the rest of the festive season. We're getting through the semester faster than ever here at Glucksman Ireland House. It feels like each year, each semester goes faster than the one prior. And we're winding down now. We had a lovely event on Thursday night. Our colleague, Nick Wolfe, who you've heard on the program in recent weeks, launched his new book on the Irish language in the century between 1770 and 1870. An Irish-speaking Island is the name of the book, and if any of you are interested, it is available online or at the NYU bookstore and is well worth a read over the holiday season. For anyone who's interested in a fascinating aspect of the linguistic and social and cultural history of Ireland in that century after 1770. So, cohorticus, congratulations, Nick. It was a lovely event. We're so delighted and proud of your accomplishments with this publication. And we look forward to many more because we know that it has also led to ongoing research projects. And he did mention that he will come in and have a chat to us about those research projects at some point in the future. If any of you are listening to the program today and you are at a loose end, later in the afternoon, Kate Feary, who is an alum of the Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies here at NYU, and she is archival manager for the Archdiocese of New York. She's been on the program once or twice with us before. She is going to give a presentation this afternoon at 2 p.m. at the McCluskey Meeting Room Parish House at Old St. Patrick's Cathedral on 263 Mulberry Street. It's from 2 to 3:30 p.m. today, and this is part of the New York Irish History Roundtable series of lectures, a really fantastic dynamic series of talks that they put on every year. And Kate will talk about finding your ancestors in Catholic New York. So she's going to talk about strategies for discovering and using Catholic religious records, which are really rewarding resources for information about Irish Catholic ancestors who lived in New York beginning in the early 1800s. And she'll talk about what a family history researcher can expect to find, the locations of christening, marriage and funeral records, how records can be accessed, and whether permissions are necessary, and what else a researcher can expect to find. So we'd highly recommend anyone who has free time today to pop along to that talk at Old St. Patrick's Cathedral. It will be a very informative event, I'm sure. 100 years ago, Big Jim Larkin, a person who was made famous by the 1913 Dublin lockout, came to New York. He came to New York City, and he stayed here for a number of years. We had the pleasure earlier in the semester of welcoming Professor Emmett O'Connor from the University of Ulster to talk about Big Jim Larkin's time in New York. And I am delighted to have the opportunity to share with you the interview I undertook with Professor Emmett O'Connor to hear about Jim Larkin's time in New York and the aftermath of the lockout and how he busied himself with labour activity here in New York 100 years ago. So I look forward to very much sharing that interview with you, who is actually a New York native. He was born here in New York and he was here for the run of the production Lippy, which ran in conjunction with the Irish Arts Centre and Abrams Arts Centre recently here in New York on Grand Street. It was a very well received production, and the gentleman in question is Dan Reardon, fine actor, is very familiar to people in Ireland for the myriad of roles he has undertaken on stage and on screen, and he took time out of his schedule before he returned to Ireland to come in and have a chat to me, not only about the production Lippy, which he will talk a little bit about when you hear my chat with him, but he also talked about his journey into the world of acting. In 1970, Dan moved to Ireland to study at Trinity College Dublin. He was undertaking an MLit, a Master's on Spencer. And he talks about the evolution of his career, how he ends up as a member of the RTE Players. And he talks about the journey through the life of an actor in Ireland. It's a rather unusual and interesting story because he goes in the opposite direction of what many Irish actors would do by going to Ireland and then quite accidentally getting into the world of acting. And he's going to have a chat with us about all that, and it's very, very interesting. You'll hear an announcement from my colleague, Professor John Waters, in a moment, reminding us of our next MA Open House on the 12th of December. And we would like to encourage any of you interested in our Masters in Irish and Irish American Studies to consider coming along to that MA Open House on Friday, December 12th. Right before that, we have our last event of the formal programming of our fall program for Glucksman Ireland House NYU 2014, the fall program. And that is the Ornell na Nollag, our Christmas concert, which is coordinated so ably by Padraig O'Carroll, our senior Irish language lecturer. And that will take place on Thursday, the 11th of December. That's next Thursday, folks. So please feel free to come along and get into some of that festive cheer. We do have our last Blarney Star concert as well, which is on the night of the MA Open House. That's Friday, December 12th. We'll have Willie Kelly and his wife Siobhan playing that night here at 8 p.m. at Glucksman Ireland House. And one other thing I'd like to draw your attention to before we hear about Jim Larkin is the series of concerts which will take place between December 18th and December 20th, an Irish Christmas, a musical solstice celebration. Mick Maloney, who is a professor, member of our faculty here at Glucksman Ireland House and a renowned performer and ethnomusicologist, he will be leading his lovely annual tribute to Christmas on December 18th to 20th. And Mick is going to come in and have a chat to us about that next week. So I look forward to that and to possibly sharing some of the sounds from his new album, which is of the same title, An Irish Christmas. Those concerts will take place at the Symphony Space at Peter J. Sharp Theatre, 2537 Broadway at 95th Street. They're not on in the Irish Arts Centre, they're actually on in Symphony Space. So we're delighted to encourage people to think about attending those concerts. They're always very popular and well received. So first, back to Jim Larkin.
Hi, I'm John Waters. I'm the director of the MA program in Irish and Irish American Studies at Glucksman Ireland House at New York University. This is an interdisciplinary MA program encompassing the study of history, literature, music, language, and culture. We're now accepting applications for fall 2015, and generous scholarship money is available. We'd like to invite you to visit Ireland House for an MA program open house with faculty, current students, and alumni. That'll be held on Friday, December 12th, from 5 to 7 p.m. Hope to see you there.
So I'm here with Dr. Emmett O'Connor, who is a senior lecturer in history at the University of Ulster, and he's here at Glucksman Ireland House NYU to speak about the life of the Irish political and labour figure popularly known as Big Jim Larkin and his controversial involvement with the Socialist Party of America. It's great to have the opportunity, Professor O'Connor, to talk to you one-on-one about your research on Larkin, and specifically for a New York audience. to hear about his activities here in New York. Can you tell me a little bit about how, looking at your list of publications, I suppose it's a natural progression for you to have gotten into Larkin? What was the origin of your research on Larkin himself?
Yeah, well, if you do Irish labour history, you can't avoid Big Jim Larkin. But I had no intention of writing a biography of Larkin until I was asked by Cork University Press back in the, I think it was 1998. They were producing a series called Radical Irish Lives at that time, and they asked me to do a short biography of Larkin, and I thought that's really no problem because there's a lot written about Larkin up to the 1913 lockout, and then there are very few sources on Larkin after the lockout. The perception of Larkin is that he was the great hero of the lockout, and he's not so much discussed before and after. But when I began to look into his subsequent career, I found that, in fact, there were quite a number of sources. There's an FBI file on Larkin, which runs to almost 500 pages. And he also had a lot of contact with the Communist International in Moscow in the 1920s. And the communists didn't throw a paper away. At least the Russians didn't. They kept very good archives. And all his correspondence with Moscow is detailed there. And of course, that was completely inaccessible, or at least very difficult to get at, before the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. But subsequently, they had a very liberal access policy in the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. So all this material suddenly became available. And we now know quite a lot about Larkin, including his life after the lockout.
So I suppose the lockout is such a big event and moment in and of itself, and then it's followed so quickly after by other dramatic Irish history. Is that part of the reason that the story of him dropped off a little bit after the lockout?
Yeah, he kind of becomes displaced because he goes off to America the year after the lockout, and he kind of disappears, really. He comes back then in 1923. Nothing much was known about the American years. But also when he came back, he was a very dictatorial character. He was a man with strong good points, strong bad points, very black and white character. And if you're trying to assess Larkin, you do end up saying, well, on the one hand and on the other hand, and so on. Mm-hmm. And in the 1920s, to some he was a hero, to some he was a villain. Mm-hmm. And I think after his death in 1947, the labour movement didn't quite know how to deal with his legacy and his memory. But when the 50th anniversary of the lockout came along in 1963, labour appreciated this was a hugely important event in Irish history. It was the one kind of big event in Irish labour history which sort of thrust itself into the mainstream narrative. But you couldn't really deal with the lockout without talking about Larkin. So a kind of consensus grew up that they would treat Larkin as the hero of the lockout and forget about what happened before, forget about what happened after. Because mm-hmm. when he came back, he wanted to restore his dictatorial control of the Union and get rid of the people who had taken over in the meantime. And they thought, well, you know, he went off to America when things were bad after the lockout. We rebuilt the Union. We stayed here during the struggle for independence, and some of us were arrested and interned, and some Union officials were shot and so on. And Larkin was off there in New York and places beyond. So they weren't going to accept Big Jim back as the boss, and that led to a split in the Union.
Specifically on Larkin and his role?
Yeah, I think the split has been kind of rationalised by some historians as a kind of an ideological split between right and left, with, you know, Larkin the revolutionary and the people who succeeded him as being more moderate. But I don't think that's valid. I think it was really just about Larkin wanted to, you know, he wanted his Union back. And he tried physically with some of his followers to take over control of the Union headquarters. He was expelled as General Secretary, and that led to a court case in 1924, which he lost. He was a very litigious kind of character. He then went off to Moscow in 1924, and it was in his absence that his brother Peter and his eldest son, Young Jim, founded the Workers' Union of Ireland. And there was a kind of civil war in the Dublin labour movement between the Transport Union and the Workers' Union for the next, you know, 30, even 40 years, right, which is really quite disastrous for the labour movement. But these two unions finally came back together as SIP2 in 1990.
What do you think, from your research, Larkin made of New York as a city, or the United States more generally? Did he enjoy his time here?
I think he did, although he did complain about it also. But the reason he came here was that Big Bill Haywood of the Wobblies, one of the, you know, the huge characters on the far left of the American labour movement, a leading figure in the industrial workers of the world, he suggested to Larkin that he might go on a speaking tour of the US during the 1913 lockout. And Larkin decided that he would like to go in December of 1913, but he didn't want to be seen as running away from the impending defeat for the Union, and the membership didn't want him to go. But the struggle against the Dublin employers was called off in January of 1914, and it was a huge setback for the Union. But they still believed in Larkin and in his leadership, which was a remarkable tribute to Larkin. But privately, he was canvassing about going overseas. He was writing to Butte, Montana. He was writing to friends in New York. He was writing to people in South Africa, Australia, New Zealand about a world speaking tour. And finally, he did leave then, arriving in New York in November of 1914. And the idea was that he would go on a lecture circuit in the US and then maybe go on to Canada and then maybe go on to Australia, New Zealand and so on. But he didn't get beyond the United States. It kind of went wrong for him because he sort of fell between two stools. He got involved with the leading Irish-American Republican group, Clonagail. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were now planning for a rising in Dublin with German help. And their leader, John Devine, was very happy to make use of Larkin as a speaker. But Larkin also wanted to work mainly with the American labour movement, and he got too close to the Nationalists for Labour, and then he got too close to the far left for the Nationalists. And by the spring of 1915, he was finding it harder and harder to get speaking engagements. It's also, I think, to some extent, his oratorical style. He was a great gifted orator. He had a powerful, booming voice. He could talk for 3 or 4 hours at length without notes. But he had a terrible tendency to attack colleagues on the left or in the Nationalist movement, and this didn't go down too well. He wasn't at all diplomatic, and he was inclined to speak off the top of his head. So the kind of oratorical style which worked so well at a strike meeting or on a street corner didn't go down so well, you know, in the more formal setting of a theatre, right, or a public hall. So that made it more difficult for him. But he finally got the Socialist Party to arrange a lecture tour of the Far West in the summer of 1915, and he went off to places like Fresno and San Francisco in California. He got good reviews for his lectures, but he couldn't make a living out of it. So he then took a job as an organizer for the Western Federation of Miners. Now, that wasn't the sort of work he wanted at all, because that's what he'd come to America to get away from, the drudgery of union work, and to be an agitator rather than an organizer. So through his contacts in Clonagail and John Devine, he arranged a deal with the officials of the German embassy that he would undertake anti-war agitation in return for substantial sums of money from the Germans. The Germans had offered him this deal before and he turned it down because it wouldn't have gone down well with the American labour movement if they'd known that he was taking money from the Kaiser, as it were. The position of America at the time is that it was neutral. The American left was very largely against America being drawn into the war because they felt if it did join the war, it would be doing so for profit, for big business, for the big munitions companies. But the problem for the Germans was that they couldn't trade with the US because of the British naval blockade. But the British and French were both trading and getting a lot of munitions from America. So in a purely industrial sense, America was on the side of the British and French, and it was a very frustrating situation for the Germans. So the money he got from the Germans allowed him to settle in Chicago for 2 years to bring his wife and 2 of his 4 children over from Dublin, and to edit a newspaper, which is something that he always liked doing. So he brought out a Chicago edition of the Irish Worker in 1916. But he broke with the Germans in 1917, or they broke with him. He claims that they were pushing him to undertake sabotage work, and he didn't want to do that. Now, we only have his word for it. And with Larkin, you can't entirely rely on him. You know, he can be a bit selective in giving his version of events. But according to himself, they broke with him and left him penniless in Mexico City in October of 1917. He then went to the West Coast and started working with the Wobblies. And then in early 1918, he came back to New York, moved again into Greenwich Village. He seemed to like living in Greenwich Village and lived not too far from here in Patchen Place. And he joined the Socialist Party.
And he would have had his wife and kids with him then?
No, she had returned to Dublin in August of 1916. I think relations were getting a bit strained between the two, because subsequently, when Larkin was imprisoned in New York, she was approached to support a campaign for his release, and she refused. So when he returned to Dublin in 1923, the two didn't live together again for the rest of their lives.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So were the two kids, they were old enough to stay in Ireland, the 2 of the 4, is that the logic there?
Yeah, by this stage he had four children, 4 boys, and the youngest, Barney, had been born in August 1914, only 2 months before he left for America. So his wife, I think, had certain, you know, she felt she had been somewhat neglected by him, right, that he'd always put the movement first, and he really was a man who was married to the movement, mm-hmm, and, you know, he wasn't much given to sort of home life and home duties and so on.
So is he actually then in New York City in 1916 when news of the rising breaks and stuff?
No, he's in Chicago at that
right,
time, yeah.
And what, do you know what his reaction to that would have been and stuff like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, see, he had this terrible problem with jealousy and he was very jealous of James Connolly. People tend to think of Connolly and Larkin as kind of two, you know, co-equal leaders of the labour movement, but in fact Larkin was the main man, because Connolly was good at persuading people who were willing to sit down and listen to him, but he's not good at standing on street corners and bringing in the masses, mm-hmm. which Larkin could do. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Connolly had been in the US. He developed an international reputation as a very good propagandist. He'd written a few pamphlets which had been much praised in the labour movement. So he wasn't just your average union official, and any time Larkin scented a threat, the jealousy did tend to get the better of him. So when he was going to America, he wanted to appoint P.T. Daly in his place to take care of the union. But others in the union more or less forced him to appoint Connolly. So Connolly then took over as leader of the Transport Union and the Citizen Army. But Larkin knew that something was being prepared in Dublin, and he sent back two messages to Connolly to pull out of it, as he put it. Now, there was no difference between Larkin's politics and Connolly's politics. They were both Republicans. They were both very much against Britain in the war. They were both very much in favour of a rising. But Larkin didn't want anything happening if he wasn't a part of it. So he felt very upstaged when the news of the rising broke. And he went to ground. The newspapers in America were trying to contact him to get his views. And after a week, the New York Times finally got through to him. And all he said was, "I have nothing to say on the Irish question."
Wow. That's phenomenal.
That is absolutely incredible. And it shows you what a difficult situation it must have been for him.
You would put it down to the jealousy?
I think there's no other explanation than the jealousy, mm. that this had a very depressing effect on him.
Wow.
But he did recover his composure after about 3 weeks, and he organised a meeting in the Grand Opera House in Chicago to commemorate the leaders. By this stage, Connolly and the others had been executed by the British, so he was now commemorating them as martyrs. But his nerves were very unsettled, and there was an incident when a man in the audience heckled, and Larkin physically attacked him. He ran from the stage and jumped on him. So he was obviously under a lot of pressure.
And you don't think it's possible that it was something like that he was so devastated that Connolly had died or whatever like that?
But he said nothing.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so, because, I mean, had he been so annoyed, I mean, his deputy leader was imprisoned and then was going to be executed. He was still leader of the Transport Union. I mean, he should have come out with a statement and, you know, organised some protest about this when Connolly was still alive.
When Connolly's over, or does at least one tour, if memory serves me correctly, here, and he comes to, like, in New York City, and I assume he and Larkin would have crossed paths here in those years as well, right?
No, they didn't, because Larkin hadn't been to America by that stage. I mean, Connolly was in America, mainly in New York, between 1903 and 1910. Larkin didn't arrive until November 1914.
Right.
Though he did use Connolly's contacts, including with the Flynns in the Bronx, and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn was celebrated as the Rebel Girl by Joe Hill. He wrote a song about her.
So would Larkin ever, at any point, Emmett, she was still alive, right, Mother Jones, would he have had contact with someone like her, do you know?
Not to my knowledge. He did have some contact with the Wobblies. He was careful not to join any one organisation to avoid sort of being pigeonholed, you know, or making a hostage to fortune. He wanted to be freelance. He always wanted to do his own thing in his own way, to do what he wanted, when he wanted, how he wanted, and he didn't want to have to answer to anyone for it.
Right.
You know, that was another of his vices.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd acquired, in some ways he became even more self-indulgent in America, because he got used to the kind of freelance wandering lifestyle. He loved travel. He did a huge amount of travel across the US. And when he joined the Socialist Party, he was hardly a member of the Socialist Party in New York before he set up his own club within the party, and more or less broke with the party. He set up the New York James Connolly Socialist Club and just sort of moved into his branch headquarters and more or less ran the club from there.
So Larkin was the founder of that James Connolly?
He was, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
And I mean, that was quite influential over the years, you know, in terms of Irish socialism here,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it did attract a lot of the kind of leading Irish Labour and left-wing figures at the time. And of course, Larkin was, you know, he was a big name because he'd made his reputation worldwide as an agitator during the 1913 lockout.
Mm-hmm. Would Larkin have ever been happy to have spent the rest of his life here in the United States?
Well, he claims that from 1917 he was constantly trying to get back, and he did apply repeatedly to the British consulate in New York for a passport. But they wouldn't give him one because they didn't want him back in the UK. And in fact, they'd introduced a barring order on him in December 1914, banning him from the British dominions. So when he tried to enter Canada, he was refused entry to Canada.
Would that have been part of the reason as well that speaking tour was a little bit put off track in terms?
Yeah, it would have clipped his wings a little bit, yeah.
So he's interesting as well from the point of view, at least from a New York perspective, Emmett, in that he goes home in 1923, and within
certainly 12 months or so, you know, hundreds of the Republicans who've been on the wrong side of the things going on in Ireland are kind of coming out, and who's doing a reverse migration to what we see in that post-Civil War period in Ireland. You know, he's going back in the opposite direction, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. He was arrested during a Red Scare in November of 1919, and he was sentenced to 10 years hard labour in May of 1920 and sent into Sing Sing.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a campaign then for his release, and he was eventually pardoned by Al Smith, then governor of New York, in January of 1923, on the ground that he'd been in prison for his political beliefs, and he was really a political prisoner, rather than for anything that he had actually done. What he intended to do next is, it's not entirely clear. He did try to raise funds to send a food ship back to Ireland to help refugees who were being forced out of Belfast by the Orange pogroms in Belfast at that time. But at the same time, he spoke about staying in America. He spoke about going elsewhere. Meanwhile, the FBI, and in particular J. Edgar Hoover, were trying to get rid of him. Hoover took the view that all this trouble was caused by all of these European agitators coming over here. What we need to do is get rid of these people. So Hoover's problem was that he really didn't have hard evidence that Larkin had actually broken the law. So they finally got a speech that he'd made in New York in early 1918, and they concluded that this amounted to advocating the overthrow of the government. You know, that was sort of pushing it a bit, because Larkin was always very careful not to give the authorities an excuse to arrest him.
Right.
But Hoover decided that that was it, and he'd had the evidence. So Larkin was arrested and then deported and sent back to Southampton. Now, the Civil War was just about coming to an end. He arrived back in Ireland on the 30th of April of 1923, and the Civil War was called off formally a few weeks later. The Republicans had high hopes of Larkin, because he had been quite close to them here in the US, and they thought that he would rally the Labour movement behind the Republican movement in Ireland, because the people who had taken over control of the Labour Party, they were much more moderate, they were more pro-free state. But Larkin was to disappoint the Republican movement in that respect, and they didn't quite trust him after that. But after the Civil War, it's true that a lot of Republicans found that they simply had to get out, because it was just impossible to get work.
Mm-hmm.
And
I know many of them came here. In your research then, so the likes of Devoy had a lot of respect for Larkin, do you think?
He did to begin with, yeah. He was a great admirer of Larkin, but he fell out with him by 1923, because curiously, although Devoy, you know, he was very much a hardline Irish Republican, he supported the treaty and supported the new Irish government, and so he and Larkin would have differed on that point. But also Larkin, of course, when he went back to Ireland, some people accused him of running away, you know, and being out of the country right throughout the whole troubled times, and he said that the real reason he'd gone to America was not to raise funds for his union, but in fact it was to work with people like John Devoy to organise a rising and get weapons from Germany for the rising in Dublin. And Devoy was very annoyed about that and said that isn't the case, and published a big attack on Larkin in the Gaelic American,
right,
which is
his newspaper.
Yeah, his paper, yeah.
And do you, in your research, Emmett, have you a sense of how this period that Larkin's here in New York, even New York City alone, and even most of those other places that you mention in the US he ends up travelling to, there's substantial Irish-born populations in those communities. Do you have a sense as to how the average Irish immigrant here grubbing along in life in urban America, how they perceived Larkin?
That's, I think, is a bit more difficult to establish. He undoubtedly, he was a popular orator and he always attracted big crowds, but at the same time he was inclined to antagonise people and antagonise some Irish Americans because for his attacks on the US government.
Mm.
And he also suffered from the fact that some of his critics on the left were inclined to misrepresent him, and he was often referred to as an anarchist, which he wasn't. There was also another incident when he was supposed to have referred to the US flag as a rag, and then he said he hadn't called it a rag, he said it was a Union Jack he was calling a rag, and so on.
Right.
These sort of things seemed to dog him at every turn. And of course he was operating on the far left, so I suppose the mainstream Irish Americans would not have subscribed to the kind of politics that he was advocating.
He's a product of the Irish diaspora himself. Would you mind telling us a little bit about his background in terms of his connections with Liverpool and his time in Scotland and things like that?
Yeah, he was born in Liverpool in 1874. Both of his parents came from around Newry. He would claim to have been born in the maternal family homestead in South Down and then taken to Liverpool at an early age. But I think most historians think that he was born in Liverpool. He certainly spoke with a broad Liverpool accent.
He did.
Throughout his life, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. But when he came to Ireland, it's remarkable he regarded himself as being Irish. Of course, he grew up in an Irish dockland community in Liverpool. But he had a strong affinity with Ireland all the time, but he's not known to have been in Ireland before 1907, when he would have been 33 years of age. But once he did come to Ireland, he adjusted to the country very quickly, and he brought his wife to join him. So obviously he was thinking of settling in Ireland long term, whereas when he'd been in Scotland, you know, he hadn't asked his wife to join him. And when he came to Ireland, he would always insist that he was an Ulster man. Throughout his life, he called himself an Ulster man.
So his wife was a Liverpudlian as well?
Yeah, she was from a very different background. It had a different kind of character and outlook. And I mean, one of their grandchildren described him as a marriage of chalk and cheese. She was the daughter of a Baptist lay preacher. Elizabeth Brown was her name. And her father ran a temperance cafe. So Larkin was a strong advocate of temperance throughout his life. His idea of taking her out and showing her a good time would be to take her to a socialist meeting in Liverpool. But the two, they bonded, they got married in 1903. Curiously, it was a civil ceremony. They got married in a registry office in 1903. Larkin always had a kind of an ambiguous attitude to religion. He always regarded himself as a Catholic, but he's not known to have practiced until a sort of a deathbed conversion in 1947. But when he was filling in the 1911 census in Dublin, for example, mm-hmm. he not only put himself and the children down as Catholics, but his wife too was listed as a Catholic.
Even though there's no record of her ever converting?
No, there's not. No, there's not.
It strikes me, Emmett, in talking to you that, you know, as you kind of said, he's kind of a mercurial figure. They're a lot of fun to investigate as historians, aren't they? You know, the forward and back in terms of the swings and turns of someone like that. It's been an enriching research journey for you.
Yeah, quite amazing, really, because when I started out looking at Larkin, I didn't think there was much left, much new to be said on him, because he didn't keep any private papers. You know, his coat pocket was his filing cabinet, and whatever he needed, he would sort of carry around, you know, on his person, and didn't bother with any record, even when he was head of the union. But as you say, he was a very mercurial character, you know, strong good points, strong bad points. You could argue about Larkin all night. And he had such an interesting life, you know, going from Liverpool to Ireland, the United States, Mexico, then back to Ireland, and then he made four visits to Moscow in the 1920s. And then there were so many sides to him. You know, he was a socialist, he was a Republican, a trade union leader. And then there's the interesting questions of his relations with his wife and his family, particularly his brother Peter, who was here in New York for a time, and his attitude to things like religion, which were quite ambiguous as well.
Mm-hmm.
So he is an endlessly fascinating character.
Well, listen, Emma, thanks for taking time out of your schedule to sit down and share with us your insights on this fascinating figure. I'm delighted that the Labour Historians and Archivists Gathering has brought you to the campus, and thanks for coming into Ireland House.
Thank you very much.
I'm here with Dan Reardon, and he has just come off a production that has received a lot of critical acclaim in the theatre world of New York City, which isn't easy, as our listeners know, in terms of the range of things going on at any given point in time here in this city. I'm referring to the production of Lippy. It was co-produced, correct me if I'm not mistaken, Dan, by the Irish Arts Centre.
The Irish Arts Centre and Abrams Arts Centre down on Grand Street. Yes.
So tell me about that production and your involvement in it and what's going to happen next.
Okay. So Lippy was conceived 2 years ago by this company called Dead Centre, made up of Bush McCarzel, Ben Kidd and Adam Welsh. And they saw this report in the papers of an incident that happened in the year 2000 of these three women, the Maroonies. They were three sisters and an aunt who had disappeared in a housing estate in Leixlip and were found subsequently 30 days afterwards. All of them were found dead in the house, having starved themselves to death. And it was a collective suicide pact. Now, this story was reported not hugely, and a lot of people missed it in the year 2000 when it happened. And so it wasn't very well known, but it was one of these very, very mysterious and inexplicable situations, and the Guardian were involved in trying to work out what actually happened to them. And from what they can gather, the verdict was in the end that it was a collective suicide pact, that they decided to reunite themselves with God and leave this mortal world behind.
Together.
Now, there was an elderly auntie, and she died within 10 days. But the three sisters, because they made the mistake of drinking water as well as not eating, but they were drinking water, which prolonged the agony. And two of the sisters were caught on CCTV camera in Stephen's Green Shopping Centre. And this is where the fiction of the play and the facts of the actual incident become sort of interweaved, that the Garda Síochána then employ the services of a lip reader, a professional lip reader, to interpret what the two sisters were saying, to try and get an idea of what was going on in their minds before they disappeared. And that's the idea of the play. I play the lip reader. I tell the story of the four women, how they disappeared, how the house was broken into by the landlord, and then the Garda came in, and what was found. And then I, by way of the conventions, the theatrical conventions, and the liberties that theatre can afford people, I enter their world. I go back in time to be in the house with them, and there's elements and sort of themes of King Lear and his daughters, and what he could have done, what he might have done to help save them, perhaps. And so it's not a documentary as to how these women, the last days of their lives, it's more really a testament and a monument to their spirit and the idea of what they were going through. It opened in Dublin in the Fringe Festival in 2013, and it won the Best Production in the Fringe, subsequently went on to win Best Production in the Dublin, in the Irish Times Theatre Awards, and was subsequently invited to the Edinburgh Festival, where it won 4 awards, a Herald Angel, a Fringe First, a Total Theatre Award, and another one. So critically acclaimed, and the reaction from the audiences are all seeming very, very powerful. It's hard for somebody in the production to gauge just what the emotional impact of the presentation is. But I feel as a performer, it's wrenching, it's very disturbing, but at the same time quite inspirational, and it makes you consider and reflect on your own humanity and how you exist in the world and how you behave towards your fellow man.
Has there been a difference from the qualification you've made, Dan, in terms of how much an actor can judge when you're in the throes of delivering your lines and being sensitive to the role? But can you discern any differences in how, say, the British or Irish audiences reacted over the New York audiences? Are there any cultural conventions or references in the play that make the audience react in different ways, or no?
Oh, yes. Now, what happens with this, it's in 3 parts. The first part is Bush Mukarzal is there with the sound technician Adam Welsh, and they're standing on the stage with just 3 chairs, and Bush Mukarzal then welcomes the audience to this post-show talk. Thanks very much, everybody, for staying around. You don't usually get this many people for a post-show talk, but we're quite happy, you know, and we're waiting for a few of the actors to come out and talk about how they made the show. And in Ireland and in Edinburgh, this immediately, people started laughing, because it's flipping the convention. Here we start a presentation, start a theatre piece, with a post-show talk. Of what? There's just been a play on. So I'm the actor, I'm brought on the stage, here's Dan Reardon, he's come on. So, you know, it was great, it was fantastic, I've never seen anything like it. And then I go and talk about what it's like to be a lip reader. But the other night, in the audience, Bush McCall was saying, thanks very much, people, for staying around. And one man got up and started walking out of the theatre. And he was convinced he had come to the wrong show. And he actually said, I thought I was coming to see Lippi. Yeah, well, this is Lippi. This is just this part of Lippi. And talking about it, just that irony button, or that kind of, in New York and America, it's literal. What you see is what you get. There's no nuance, and irony don't really compute as they do in Ireland and in the UK. That was one sort of interesting
reaction, yeah. So it's going on somewhere next as well.
Well, it goes back to Dublin. We were in Germany with it in Wiesbaden. The Germans went crazy about it. And again, I find it hard to talk about it. It becomes quite difficult to talk about. For instance, you know, and we've all done plays where we're in tears and we're all Hamlet and Lear, and you know, you're wrecked afterwards and you're all emotional. But then you say, well, it's only a play. But this isn't only a play. This is real. This is a true story. And how on earth did this happen? How in God's name did this happen? And what did you do about it? And what did anybody do about it? You see, anyway, it's a different experience, this piece. It's unique.
Mm-hmm.
And the Germans, of course, are very intense. And they would be asking me questions afterwards. And You were there in the room. What did you? How could you let them do it? You know, and all this. I said, well, you know, And then I remember talking to this woman in Wiesbaden very late at night. The festival tent was going on, and music and everything. And the two of us, after a while, we just started weeping, just sobbing, you know, as to why and how. And was, you know, that's 2 years I've been with this show now, on and off. You know, it hasn't been a continual run. I don't think I'd be able for a continual 2 years of it.
Very emotionally draining.
Oh, I find it like nothing I've ever done, you know, and I've done a lot of stuff in 45 years and more, you know. And as I say, you know, tragedies can be all very difficult, but you have that facility to say that it is only a play, whereas something like this is just so, and it's very immersive and very, and the four women, the performers are stunning, you know, they're just wonderful in it. Leave O'Donoghue and Joanna Banks, they're both dancers. Gina Moakesley and Katrina Numurica are the actors playing the sisters, and then Joanna Banks is the auntie. And just the way they move and look on the stage and what they do in the play is quite astounding, really.
I wanted to use the opportunity while I had Dan Reardon here with us at Luxman Ireland House NYU to talk to him about his journey into the world of acting and how he first got involved in the craft and how he has basically carved out over 44 years such an impressive career in the world of acting and has travelled all over the world. So he started off by telling me about how he actually first got into acting. It was actually here in New York City before he ever went to Ireland in 1970 as a young man. So take a listen to this.
While I was in New York, and while I was at Fordham, I got involved in the Mimes and Mummers, which was the acting, the drama society there. And there was a legendary man called Vaughan Deering, who lived in the Lambs Club. And he was an old-fashioned Shakespearean actor, and a real character. And he would direct all the plays for Mimes and Mummers, all the student productions. And I had done lots of drama at Loyola, you see, I was kind of one of the bright sparks in the drama society there. We did some things. And Vaughan Deering, I suppose, saw some kind of a spark or a talent. Anyway, he decided that I would be one of his acolytes. You know, he'd take me under his wing, which he did. He'd mentor me, which he did. And he introduced me to people in the Lambs Club down 44th Street. He took me down to Provincetown Playhouse just here on McDougal Street when it was just over here. And I started hanging around there and doing stage handing and walk-on parts in their plays, and then Ibsen's Ghosts, I think, was the first production I was involved in. And generally watching the professions and the professionals at their work, this was magic. Now, in the 60s in New York, there were legendary theatrical productions. Richard Burton's Hamlet was here, Schofield's Lear was here, you know. There was wonderful theater going on in New York in the 60s. I remember seeing a production of Strange Interlude with Jane Fonda that went on for 5.5 hours. And anyway, I realized that, okay, academics would be my profession, but my love, let's say, my heaven will always be theater. So when I went to Trinity to become an academic, as I say, I gravitated towards the Trinity players, you know, because they would seem to be fun people. They were all very attractive people, of course, and they seemed to have wonderful parties, and they were doing some interesting productions in their little theater there, number 4 in Front Square, players. So I got involved in the production of The Tempest, with Michael Colgan was in that production, and then started getting involved in the theater scene in Ireland, in Dublin, which, you know, was very small, very accessible, great fun, very exciting. And then decided that, really, this is a lot more attractive and fun, and the possibility of making a living on this. So I auditioned for the RTE Players in 1974.
At this point, had you completed your deal, Spencer?
Yep, I had done that. Realized that academics can be a pretty dodgy place in terms of the politicking that goes on, the pressures of tenure and publishing. And there's a lot of things that disenchanted me with academics, let's say. Nothing to do with the material or the actual product itself, but it was all to do, I think, with the power games and the maneuverings that goes on. You know this in academic circles. And, as I say, I was having a great time doing plays.
And what did auditioning for the RTE players, did that mean you would have regular gigs in terms of...
Well, that's what happened in those days. There was the Abbey Company and the Rep, the RTE players, Radio Éireann players, the Rep. And they were the only two permanent companies in the country. And they were virtually civil servants. You know, they were deemed almost as like a civil servant, except what you did was, your job was to act in plays. So it was highly prized. Now, I've been working in the Abbey recently, and you remember the stories of how in those days the hierarchy of the company was daunting, to say the least. But I was welcomed into the RT players with open arms, and they were magical people, Eamon Keane and George Green and Conor Farrington and, you know, the legend Aidan Grinnell and the legendary household name Daphne Carroll and Peg Monaghan, and they were so wonderful, and it was so great to watch them working and listen to them and how they operate, and just I just sat there with Brian O'Higgins and Amy and just listened to them, watched them and listened to them, and so I was in heaven again.
So was coming back to New York, the place you'd been born and raised, when did that go out the window?
Well, yeah, that's what happened. I got this 2-year contract initially, and then 76, the contract was renewed, and I had met this extraordinary woman, and I thought I'd never met anybody like her. You know, she was really quite extraordinary, and I couldn't see what she saw in me. But we got married in 77.
So... your wife is from Ireland, Dan?
Well, she was born in England. Her father's from Tipperary. Her mother's from Cavan.
Oh, so you were kindred spirits in a way.
Her mother's from near Swanland Bar, yeah.
So, but...
out in the Hullion. Yeah.
By getting married, though, in 77, Dan, were you making a commitment, though, to staying in Ireland for at least the foreseeable future?
Well, that's how it looked. And I remember my mother coming over, of course, for the wedding and looking beautiful. And my father came over for the wedding. Looking back on it now, you know, it was hard. It was difficult for her. I mean, she would have liked to have had me back in New York, you know.
Mm-hmm. Since then, you've carved out a really, you know, it seems like a very rich career path.
I've been blessed, absolutely blessed. And my association with RTE went on for nearly 30 years.
What, from your point of view, in terms of the craft, in terms of what inspires you as an actor, what have been the highlights of your career?
Oh, well, there's so many of them in terms of, I think, and the thing about the RT players and RT at that time, they would encourage you to seek stage work and film work and television work. This would help you to be fully fulfilled as an actor and, you know, rounded and be good for your career, your experience, your knowledge of the mm-hmm. craft. And they were absolutely right. And they had a very enlightened attitude in those days. So I was lucky to be able to go out and do stage productions. In 78, there was a production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with Liam Neeson and Ray McAnally and Tom Hickey, and Joan O'Hara was Nurse Ratchet. And I was Martini, I was one of the loonies, and it was a fantastic experience. And, I mean, to this day, I mean... I remember seeing Liam Neeson in The Crucible here in about 2004, thereabouts, and meeting him afterwards. And, you know, I went up to the dressing room, and in the dressing room, Shirley MacLaine, Sarah Jessica Parker, Matthew Broderick, all these people visiting him, saying how wonderful, and he was fantastic in his John Proctor in The Crucible, with Laura Linney as the wife. He was great. And he said, I haven't seen this man in 20 years. So everybody was told to kind of go home. And he sat there with me, and I had my daughter, my youngest daughter, with me at the time. She was 15 or 16. Eyes just
lit up.
And Natasha was with him in the dressing room as well. God rest her. And they were just so beautiful and warm. And he's a wonderful man.
It strikes me, Dan, in talking to you, that for many actors, many Irish actors, you've taken the reverse migration trip in terms of you left New York City, this world renowned center of for people it's the height of the craft of what you were interested in.
Of course, yeah.
Have you thought about that?
Oh, I did. Yeah, of course. On paper you look at it and it makes no sense whatsoever. But I think it was the fact that I always felt that Ireland had for me it was a spiritual home of a kind. And I mean, growing up the Irish American heritage and the sensitivities and the sensibilities were always there. As I say, with the 60s revival and the Clancy Brothers and folk music and folklore and Irish literature, and of course you fall in love with Joyce and with Beckett and you immerse yourself in this literature and you just think, well, this is... So when I went to Dublin, I didn't feel at all as an outsider, really. Okay, I was from New York, but you see, they said, oh, you're American. I said, I don't know, I'm not. Well, I am an American passport, but really, I mean, I only know the Manhattan. I went from one island to another island. So really, and New York is really the only experience. I mean, you meet people in Ireland who've been to the States, and they know more about America than I do.
Was there an affinity for you, and presumably as well for your wife, because you were of Irish descent?
Oh, yeah.
You benefited from the people recognizing that kind of connection?
I think so. You know, I think I can't speak for everybody, and maybe people do say, what's this New York git doing here, you know, and what's he up to?
You know, when people meet you and things like that, then, you know, you don't have a strong, I don't hear much of an American accent and things like that.
I suppose not, no.
But you've been there long enough that it just...
Yeah, and when you're working, as I was initially in the radio rep, and you would be required to do 3 or 4 different parts in a week sometimes, you know, you'd do the play of the week, you'd do children's stuff. And part of the auditioning process for the RT players at the time, you had to... evidence of facility and being at home with all the different Irish accents, and you're given pieces to say from Belfast to Cork to the west of Ireland, and then just to see how proficient and at ease you were with Irish accents. So that had to be spot on, and I suppose I was lucky in being able to get that to enough of a level for them to say, well, he has a quality, and they offered me the contract. But when I was a young actor in the company then, you just go with it, and you listen, you hear, you listen to what's been given to you, and you give it back. So I suppose over those years, whatever accent I did have, and I was never aware of any accent, you know, and I remember my father telling me, yeah, of course, you had a New York accent, of course you did. But I don't remember having a New York accent. Mm-hmm. You know, you speak, you say things. And it's still to this day, I don't know how I sound.
Since 1970... That you're 44 years in Ireland now, right?
Yeah.
You've seen a change hugely.
Oh, enormous. I mean, the city, when I arrived, I thought, oh, this place is fantastic in 1970. You know, I can walk up and down, go into particular, there's Neary's, you see the actors, you see the McDades, there's the poets, in the Duke, there's another crowd of people, and O'Neill's would be another crowd of people, and it was magnificent. It was such a vibrancy, and everybody seemed to be involved in either writing things or creating things or painting things, and it was a wildly exciting time and very small city.
Was there no point at which, Dan, you or your wife, more particularly you because of your profession, was there no point where you said, would we try New York? What made you stay in Ireland?
The first thought that comes into my head, the first answer to that question is the children and their education, their upbringing. And
you think the quality of life they had there would have been better than what they would have had?
I would have found it problematical to give them the education they had in Ireland here in New York on the kind of salaries that we could realistically, unless I just scored hugely in a very lucrative role or a series. And then Serena now would have had to have taken all kinds of exams here as well. I mean, she's a long-term consultant psychiatrist in Ireland and was running St. Brendan's Hospital. She was clinical director of St. Brendan's before she retired from that. And as you know, the salaries for psychiatry in Ireland. So we were able to have a very, very fine and privileged lifestyle, which would be hard to maintain, you know, to kind of the equivalent thereof in New York without a huge amount of money.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, Dan, it's fascinating interview.
Pretty fascinating to listen to hear me saying a lot of these things, but I haven't thought about so many of them and thought about them in that way for a long time, you know. Well, I don't, you know, you don't dwell on your past life so much and try and figure it out. But I have been trying to figure things out while I've been here this time. I'm here on my own, you know, and just reflecting on the way things go. And, well, you know, it's a lot of this. A lot of these things are out of your hands, really. You just sometimes you let go, you let God, you know, and you go with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I, as I say, I've been blessed, absolutely blessed.
Well, thank you, Dan. It's been a real pleasure sitting down and having a chat to you today and talking to someone who made an unusual move in terms of going across the Atlantic in that direction when you did to pursue what you do. Mm. So thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you very much, Mary. Thank you.
We're coming to the end of the programme for another week. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I want to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, on HD Radio, and worldwide on www.irishradio.com. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Jamie Sweeney, my email address is ireland.house@nyu.edu and our telephone number is 212-998-3950. If you'd like to hear this program again, please go to irishradio.com. Stay tuned for the Adrian Flanley Show up next on WVNJ 1160 AM. And for those of you listening on irishradio.com, do stay with us until noon. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht.